Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's Monday, January 1st.
2018.
Okay, we're into the new year.
Happy New Year.
A special guest.
That's right.
Sadie Abuhoff.
Per usual.
Per usual. Okay. We've been having quite the festivities
of
the holidays. Nonstop eating, cooking, running around.
Entertainment.
We went to New York recently in the snow. Every time we plan a field trip to New York, it's in the snow.
That's right. If they ever need snow, anyone ever wants to open up a ski resort in central Pennsylvania, all they have to do is buy us tickets to a Broadway play, Golden. You'll have snow.
Snow will come.
Snow will come. As it came on Saturday when we went into the city, that's the 30th, to see the band's visit.
But before you get into that, may I just mention that this is the 50th podcast?
Yeah. You can mention
it. Tamsin and Dan read the paper?
Well, the anniversary cast is coming up in a couple of weeks.
You think 52 is more important?
That would be the year, yes.
Okay. It's not exactly every week.
All right, it is.
So 50 is important.
50 is important, no question about it. So the band's visit. The band's visit, which is a much-acclaimed play on Broadway, which was great. We'll go into detail in terms of reactions in just a moment. But just to set the stage, because this is a highly unusual play, a musical. And the story is basically this. It's close to the year 2000. An Egyptian police band arrives in Israel to play a concert, but they go to the wrong town. They're looking for a town called Bet HaTikva, and they end up in a different town with a similar name. And the town they end up going to is this very small town with no cultural center, and it looks like nothing's at all going on. And what the musical is about is their experience in maybe less than 24 hours in that small town. And
where, in
it's
fact,
fantastic.
Nothing is going on.
Nothing is going on, and yet how does that play work? How does that play work?
Well, it's the same old thing. It's never about the plot. We're not interested in what's going on, really. It's about the music.
It's about the music. It's about the characters, though. It's about... Look, I found the play unique. And here's why. It's not like... we've seen many plays with Sadie. Sadie was talking last week about Pajama Game. And those plays, those musicals are great. But they follow a conventional arc, conventional storyline, and this did not. I mean, what this was about was the inner lives of these people in this very quiet town, and inner lives became a discussion of inner turmoil to some degree, and how that was developed through human interaction. Not resolved in any way, but still it resonated, and the music was so attuned to what the characters were experiencing and the human connection you were making in the audience. To me, it was almost like a poem as opposed to a standard story that you see in a Broadway musical. And I am not the kind of guy who has that kind of poetic sensibility. But it was very moving. I mean, what do you think, Say?
I thought it was very similar to Sondheim productions in general, because Sondheim...
Can we just say...
What?
That the music is by David Yazbek.
Okay.
Just so we get that out. Who also did The Full Monty, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, and I believe the theme song from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Yeah, okay. So go ahead.
So anyway, back to Sondheim.
Right.
I'm surprised you interrupted me in the middle of Sondheim, Mom. Sondheim is your favorite subject. But anyway, because Sondheim plays often don't have that much of a plot, and it's more about the characters, and it's more about their human experience, and I thought this was a lot about just the human experience and not so much a plot. There was a small plot, but it was just kind of a vehicle to get to know each of the characters.
Well, we've left out one aspect of the plot, right? The idea that it's an Egyptian band in an Israeli town.
They
have kind of opposing values. They don't speak the same language. They communicate in English.
Yeah.
For the large part, partially to convey it to the audience, but there is a great deal of tension there in that they.
I don't think they use that too much. I don't think they make a political issue of it. But going back to the way Sadie's thinking, I never thought of it that way. But I think she's right in terms of the Sondheim. I mean, Sondheim's written so many musicals. There are different musicals about different things, but a lot of them are about you know, inner feelings as much as they're anything else. And that does cause them to be a departure from some other musicals with more obvious storylines. What also was different about this, and I think even different from Sondheim, is that there are no show-stopping numbers, which is not to say that there aren't some nice songs and some even somewhat memorable songs. But when you see a play like Chicago, for example, that we saw some years ago, the Candor and Ebb musical, which is very popular on Broadway, there must have been eight different numbers which elicited a standing ovation at the end of the number because a show-stopping performance in that one play. This is just the opposite. It's a quiet, mounting, emotional experience, and which is not interrupted by stopping the show for a virtuoso performance, even though there are two great performances, particularly by Katrina Lenk, I believe is the name of the woman lead, and the male lead, Tony Shalhoub, who we know from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
And from Monk and a zillion other things.
Well, that's the one thing that I said coming out of the theater is I enjoyed it, but I'm not buying the soundtrack. Because I don't think the soundtrack is going to be that interesting. And I also am very concerned about what they're going to perform at the Tonys. Because none of their... First of all, there's no dancing. I mean, there's like minimal dancing.
Right,
maybe a little bit of dancing.
You're right.
But I feel like it's going to be hard for them to make a show of it at the Tonys and compete with, you know, the Pippins of the world or whatever's going on. Because there's going to be no real... I don't know.
I think you're right. Although I think it's going to win the Tony for Best Musical. I'd say that in part because it was on Off-Broadway and it won the 2017 Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Musical. And I think is the odds-on favorite to win, although the season's not over.
You can say there's no dancing, but there is roller skating.
There's roller skating.
There's roller
skating. So it's very close to... What is it? Starlight Express in that
Not really.
It's the next Starlight Express.
It is a play that kind of engages you, that develops a relationship with you throughout in a very subtle way. Mm-hmm. And there are heart-rending numbers. I mean, there are things that really touch you.
Right.
But nothing where you jump out of your seat.
And you're not humming them on the way out. I mean, no. One thing I asked you, which is perfectly in line with what Sadie was saying, is do they play music from this musical on the Broadway channel, which they have on Sirius FM? And I think you told me they really don't.
I'm not an expert on that. I don't listen every minute. But it's not like I was familiar. Yeah. In the way that I'm...
But the other similarity to Sondheim is the production of Company we saw probably about 8 or 9 years ago with Raul Esparza. They had everyone in the cast, almost everyone in the cast, played an instrument during the production. And that's kind of similar here. They have the band, and my guess is probably about 5 or 6 of the people are probably legitimate musicians, and then they have a couple kind of probably primary actors, but they could figure out how to play a tambourine or something. And they're playing music almost the whole time. And the band was very good.
Yeah. And you know something, that's something I didn't look up, but I probably will look up later just out of interest, is the question we asked ourselves at the end, was that David Yazbek's music that they were playing, or was that traditional Egyptian music that we were getting carried away with at the end? It's hard to even know, because the way the play ends was the band comes out and steps out of the performance mode of the play itself, steps out of character, and sits down and plays something for the last 5 minutes. And we'll have to see whether that's the aspects or not. At the time, I was convinced it was Egyptian music, but I don't really know. So anyway, that's great. We recommend it.
Experience.
We recommend it. And we saw a movie that we recommend too, and I should know the exact title.
Three Billboards Near Ebbing, Missouri.
Missouri, yeah.
So that's with Frances McDormand, and she plays a woman in the small town who has noticed there are 3 abandoned billboards, and she decides to rent them out for her personal use to try to get the local police force going on a case that she feels they have dropped the ball on. And so that's kind of the premise of the movie. In putting up these billboards, she gets the local police force a little bit enraged, I would say, and different characters kind of have different reactions to it. And there are a lot of twists and turns to the plot, and characters kind of each have their own story going on, but it was another interesting study in the human...
Well, not to give too much away, but I don't think we're giving it away. The case in question was the murder of Frances McDormand's character, his
daughter.
I was
trying to stay coy about that.
But
you know?
I think you got to put that out there because that's where all the strong feeling comes from. That's what drives the action. So Frances McDormand is extremely bitter and at her emotional edge the entire film. And the billboards are, you know, are very harsh, saying, why isn't the, in the harshest possible terms, why isn't the sheriff, a character played by Woody Harrelson, doing more to solve the murder of my daughter? And it couldn't be put in a rougher possible term. And the movie can be rough.
But it's also amusing.
Yeah.
It really has a lot of different layers. It's kind of meanders around. It's not direct.
Right.
So it's... I guess, again, very engaging and worth the trip.
It's one of those things where the good guys kind of turn into the bad guys and then become the good guys again. It's kind of hard to figure out whose side you want to be on because Frances McDormand is...
Ooh, it's a little bit like life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Frances McDormand, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, at first, you obviously want to sympathize with her because her daughter was murdered, but she's actually not the most likable character a lot of the movie. So you kind of... You learn about each person's side, and you kind of stay on the side of, okay, her daughter was murdered, so that's the worst thing that happened. But there are a lot of different stories going on.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you keep asking yourself, what's the movie about? And we were even in the car on the way home as a group. We're saying, what's the movie about? What's the movie about? Was it really about this? Was it really about that? And, you know, our best guess, and this is not to put the movie down, because I think the movie was excellent. Is that the way people handle being subjected to violence or being subjected to terrible situations and how they respond and what's an appropriate response and what's not and how you deal with, you know, what life puts in your path and is there any solution from a societal perspective? I mean, it is unpredictable. It's funny. It provokes a lot of thought.
And sad. So... All right. Seems like it's time for a museum update. Ding, 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 ding. And this time we're going to the, the National Gallery in London. Are we?
Well, you're the expert, Mom.
Oops, no. It's at the Royal Academy of the Arts in London. It's an exhibition of the collection, to the extent they're able to put it together, of the English King Charles I. Now, you may remember that not everybody's a fan of Charles I. He ends up getting beheaded, okay, after which they actually sell off his collection. He has a terrific collection. He seems to get interested in art as a young guy. When he's 23, he goes to Spain to check out the princess that he might marry. He gets to know King Philip IV, and the Spanish kings were tremendous art collectors. And so he actually, in the exhibition, they refer to this as his gap year, and he gets kind of an education in art during this trip, and he starts to collect with the works by Veronese, etc. But he has a tremendous collection with the Rubens and Titian and Veronese and Tintoretto, Mantegna, Rembrandt, etc. He's beheaded. 1649, I think, 1650. They sell off most of the stuff. Some of it gets good
prices.
Some of it goes for a song. Bruegels go for like $5.
Yeah.
And also Rubens. Nobody's a fan at that point,
really?
Apparently. Yeah. But anyway, shortly after that, actually, his son is reinstated, called back from exile, and they try to resurrect the collection. They find some of it, but not quite all of it. This is a chance to see his great collection. Some of it he bought, on special from the Gonzagas. Remember the Gonzagas?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
They sell off Isabella's studiolo.
See, this is why when we drive around...
This is where it ends up.
This is why when we drive around, we see people lining up at 7 in the morning to go to garage sales. And the reason is the Bruegels that go for $5 are gone by 10 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
If you want a $5 Bruegel, you got to get up early.
So here, Charles I's
treasure was somebody else's trash.
Yeah.
And now it's treasure again.
He was beheaded, so, you know, what did he care? He was done.
But speaking of...
The monarchy. There's one other thing we have to talk about in the entertainment world, and that is The Crown, which is the television show we're watching primarily with Sadie over the last couple of days. I would say we've been binging. Have we been binging, Sadie? Is that binging?
No. Season two?
Please.
Wait a minute. We did watch two in a row.
We watched two episodes yesterday, Sadie.
I watched 10 episodes in 2 days.
Sadie, for Mom and I, that's binging. That's as much as we can take for stimulation from The Crown. So why do we like... First of all, we all like The Crown. And the question is, why? Talk about something with, you know, a production which not a lot happens. And yet it's extremely compelling. And I'm not interested in the monarchy. I wouldn't seem to be in the demographic, but I find it spellbinding.
Well, do you think it's well written? Is that your deal?
I don't know. Sadie, why do you like it? I know you like it.
Well, I think it's produced very well. I like the whole look of it. I like all of the costumes and all of that stuff. I think it, and I also enjoy the idea of getting some vegetables with your entertainment because it is history. It's not all 100% accurate, but it's history. And I kind of like the idea of, like, if I'm worried that someone's going to get divorced, then I can just look it up on Wikipedia and say, oh, they did get divorced. Or, like, no, they didn't get divorced. So I'm not going to worry about that anymore. So there is kind of that reassurance of, like, you see Charles as a young prince and you're like, okay, I know he's going to be okay because he's still around today.
Yeah, so, well, this brings up an interesting point from an article that was in the Times this week saying that if you're getting your history from The Crown,
well, they were
or
little,
from
yeah,
The Post,
you
may be getting not the,
the
clearest,
to it.
Most accurate picture of history.
But also, like, I don't know that much about the English monarchy or the British monarchy, so... I'm getting a lot just from seeing them interacting together and seeing, you know, how the prime minister visits once a week and just things like that.
It's piquing your interest.
I'm not banking
which is important.
On every single detail, and I don't remember every single historical detail, so I'm not really too worried about that.
I thought the journal article was a little bit like they had an axe to grind on that one without going into too much detail. But I bet they're right about the divorces. Let me put it that way.
That's what the journal was going to have correct, I think.
Yeah. But I think I hadn't heard that phrase before about getting some vegetables. Would you just make that up, getting some vegetables with your entertainment, or is that in the lexicon?
It's the concept of, like, putting vegetables in macaroni and cheese so that kids eat the vegetables, you know?
How come we didn't think of that?
Well, you know, actually, remember years ago when we were on a bike trip, Sadie, in France, and we were watching, like, the French PBS, and there was a story of Louis XIV and his wife... at the end that he secretly marries and so forth. And we both got really engaged in Louis XIV. And even though we didn't understand every word of that show.
Who is not engaged in Louis XIV? He's one of my top three.
But time. Well, this show was in French, though.
It was in French.
And you got something out of it?
You know, yeah, it was historical drama. And, it was great. I mean, but I think one of the things that appeals about The Crown is there is a lot of, there's gossip, there's drama, there's soap opera aspects
to it.
And
they're doing it over... like 10 or 20 years at a time. They'll have 10 episodes over 10 years or something. So they're only picking, like, interesting little vignettes.
Right.
They're not trying to cover all this history.
But I think it is well written. I think it is well done. And I think, you know, the episodes yesterday about the prince, you know, they made him an interesting character. He hasn't been an interesting character.
Well, but they're also making the queen interesting. And
she's already established as an interesting character. I mean, that's quite clear.
But it's fun to see her as a young person because... she's been an old person for a long time.
It's just very well done. It's said to be very short. It's not what the thing's about. It's how well it's done, what the production is, and I like it.
It ain't the meat, it's the motion.
It's another way of putting it. Yes. Yes, it's just like vegetables.
All right, back to the Wall Street Journal.
No, we're doing
something else?
We're doing something else. So here, we are not going to get into the sexual harassment debate.
Because you're too scared.
The reckoning. There's just too much about that. But what I object to is misuse of statistics. That kind of bothers me, quite apart from the substance of the issue. So the Times has an article, which is a poll that they helped commission with another entity. And they published it, the headline, and in the article they cited here in their big graphic. And it's under the headline, the percentage of men who said they engaged in an objectionable behavior. Like, they asked men, you know, do you engage in objectionable behavior? What percentage of men said they did or admitted they did? And among white-collar workers, they got 24%. And among blue-collar workers, close to 40%, 38%. It's an average of a third of all workers are basically saying, you know, these are men saying, I engage in objectionable behavior.
Well, the graphic implies that. The graphic, you look at the graphic, more than that's implies what the graphic
it,
says.
It says it. And I'm saying to myself, wow, I didn't understand this issue at all. People are knowingly, you know, doing things that in retrospect they find objectionable. We do have a huge issue. Well, it turns out that's not the case. It turns out the answer that the poll provides is 180 degrees the opposite, notwithstanding they got themselves to write this headline. What the headline means is that there are a third of the men polled engaged in behavior that the Times thinks is objectionable. And then there's a list of categories of what the Times thinks is objectionable. I won't read them all, but the first one is told sexual stories or jokes that some might consider offensive. So a third of the men have told a joke that some might consider offensive. Yeah, no kidding. But in terms of people saying, I admit I engage in objectionable behavior, when asked that question, 24 of 25 men say no, I don't engage in objectionable behavior. So again, you know, when you get into a subject like this and people start throwing out numbers and taking polls and using statistics.
Well, the point is, I mean, people seem to use statistics any way they want
right.
to.
And this is just like everything else. And
but
just
it is kind of funny that...
It's all in the same article.
It's in the same article. The body of the article says one thing, and the graphic that sums it up seems to give another
impression.
So that
impression. Rant is over, Sade. It's over.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So now let's talk about poisonous colors, which is a subject we haven't given enough attention to.
Well, you're really giving away my whole excitement there, aren't you? And fun new book called The Secret Lives of Color by Kasia St. Clair, and has a bunch of interesting... I must have read a gazillion books about color in the course of studying and teaching art history, so I wasn't even going to read this review, but this book has some fun stories. One of them is about this color Scheele Green that was actually developed in 1775. It becomes all the rage. It's used in everything to color fake fruit, artificial flowers. It's in textiles. It's in wallpaper. And it turns out the great greenness of it comes from arsenic. So that means that all these things are laced with arsenic.
Yeah.
Children die from sucking on fake grapes. Flower makers die from, you know, making those artificial flowers. Even, they say, Napoleon Bonaparte dies in exile, probably because the room he's in has green, Scheele green wallpaper that killed him. Then there's a discussion of vermilion. And vermilion's a very intense red, goes back to those wonderful red walls in Pompeii, the murals in Pompeii, from the Villa of Mysteries. And it's from finely ground cinnabar. Okay, again, a sort of synthetic version of that is developed that relies on the forging of mercury and sulfur, and it's a volatile process, so that releases poisonous fumes. So in order to make this beautiful red, people die, and that's outlawed in Venice in the 13th century. But for a while, it's more expensive than gold leaf. And then another great story is about mummy brown. And it turns out that, of course, chemists are the ones who sell the colors. I mean, in that great movie about Turner, you see him sending his father to... Doesn't his father go to the store to get the pigments? Goes to, like, the chemist to get the latest, greatest pigments. Well, chemists are also selling cures, you know, powders that are used for healthful reasons as well. And there was a popular... referred to in this book as a blood-stanching mixture that was made from ground-up mummies, okay? So bitumen tar was used in the process of embalming. So anyway, this powder was used to stop blood flow, but artists saw it and loved it for the beautiful brown color, and not realizing that it was actually made from actual ground-up mummies. Allegedly, Edward Bird Jones, the wonderful Pre-Raphaelite artist and painter, was so upset when he found out, so horrified when he found out that that's where it came from, that he actually gave a decent burial to his tube of mummy brown. So that seems like a fun book based on science.
Yes, science. We can't talk enough about science. Well, you know, that's a little grisly, and I don't know if this is grisly or what. I mean, it's kind of...
Well, this will appeal to Sadie, because Sadie's a Virgo.
Okay, and so Virgos, here you go. It's about
like
cleaning
super
up.
Super cleaners.
It's about cleaning up. So organize. Sadie's, I know, intrigued already about cleaning up, except it's a book review in the Times, and the name of the book is The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning. Okay, Sadie's nodding. That's not showing up on the podcast, but she's taking it in. And what is Swedish death cleaning? It's how to sort through and dispose of many of your possessions before you die, thus sparing your family members an unpleasant task. All right?
So the top tip is do the photographs last.
Top is to do the photographs last.
Because you get totally involved in them and brings up memories. And this is what my mother tells me every week on our phone call. She says, I'm trying to organize, I'm trying to get rid of things, but I look at the pictures and I remember what it's about and I can't get any
further. Well, the corollary to that is this, and here's a quote. A loved one wishes to inherit nice things from you, not all things from you.
Yeah.
Well, the issue there is one person's treasure is another person's trash. Yes. And I think we've seen that several times over.
Well, that's the fear. What if we're throwing out the Bruegels?
Exactly. Well, that is the fear. And yet, is that something that grips you when you're 85 years old? Or is that something that people are just born with and they can't get rid of stuff because they know that that's the key Tupperware?
Well, sometimes they can't let go of it. I think part of it is it's a generational thing. For example, my grandmother left me a lot of yarn that I don't really want to use. I'm not really interested in having that yarn, and it's not valuable yarn or anything. She just didn't want to throw it away, and she thought that I would like to have yarn because I crochet.
Yeah.
But it's actually not that nice yarn. So, like, it's that type of thing of she didn't want to throw it away. She didn't want to waste it.
Right.
Well, we have the children of the Depression, okay, who see everything as useful.
Right.
And they're not going to throw it away if it's useful.
Right.
And that's true, and I understand that, except it's not – everything is not useful to everybody.
Right.
So the problem is that my parents had all these useful things that they never used. They're still there.
Well, you know, what I think that what must happen, the children of depression thing I kind of get, but what must happen is that it's just, since it's easier to hold on to thing rather than decide to dispose of it, the fallback is to say, well, I'm holding it for the next generation. You know, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do with it, but Sadie will like it, or so-and-so will like it. And then you don't have to, then you can stop thinking about it. You just put it back in the drawer. You did a good thing. But look, we're not here to criticize. It's just the way human beings are.
Yeah.
And yet
yeah.
The Swedes are a little different. The Swedes do something called Swedish death cleaning. At least
this one lady who wrote the book.
So do they say when you're supposed to start this?
Because yes, they do.
My other
issue
is that, like, if you're really, you know, in your 90s,
right,
you don't really have the energy to do this type of thing.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. She gives the answer, 65.
Okay, so... The clock is ticking.
You're looking at me. We're not 65.
Someone's turning
not 60.
Very close to 65 in a few days.
Look, Sadie,
I'm just saying.
Any minute you want, you just go through, designate the Tupperware you want, and we'll hang on
exactly.
to it for you.
Okay? You know, there's some Tupperware I've been eyeing, but I'm
willing
to let it go.
I would like the Whole Foods reusable bags.
Really?
Where do we stand on those?
Can we write that down? I don't think you're going to have a big fight on
I'm
that.
I'm coming with Post-its next time.
All right. So we had an article about a restaurant in France, which is...
Well, this is sort of sad.
Yeah.
It's a restaurant in a little town, Monceau-les-Mines, in France. It was a little mining town, and... A young fella, like 18 years ago, starts a restaurant, opens up a restaurant, a very high-end restaurant, and it's too high,
It's too high end for the area. It gets a Michelin star.
Well, it's a big deal, right? Apparently, it takes years to achieve a Michelin star. It's not something you can count on just by having a nice restaurant.
But the problem is he's not making any money. He's losing tons of money by trying to maintain this level restaurant. There's no one in the town who wants to pay the freight, the cost of a Michelin one-star meal.
Right.
So he can't make a living doing it.
But it feels like it's even a branding problem, aside from his cost problem, because he's talking in the article about the fact that people are put off from going to the restaurant because they assume, because it has a Michelin star, that it's not affordable and it's not something that would possibly cater to them, a place that they might otherwise be able to go. So it becomes almost a negative in selling the restaurant that it has the star. I don't, the thing is, I think in France it's probably more hardly felt than it is here. To lose a Michelin star seems to be bizarre, counterintuitive, and not a step in the right direction. But he purposely takes that direction here.
Yeah, and the town, to some extent, like the mayor, is upset about it.
Bereft.
He's killing jobs.
Verklempt.
Yes. And, but on the other hand, if no one's going...
He's not killing
it's
jobs.
It's not really doing the work. Just... But anyway, he's reinventing the restaurant. He's having more casual fare at more affordable prices. And, hopefully that will all work out.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. So it's New Year's. We got to talk about New Year's resolutions. Now, between the three of us, Sadie is the one who makes New Year's resolutions. And you don't have to tell us what your resolutions are, Sadie. But although I think you already have. But in any event, you seem to actually achieve your New Year's resolutions. Is that right?
I try to. I don't achieve them all the time. But usually I just kind of pick a direction and say, I want to do more of this or I want to do less of that. And try to set incremental goals toward it, or also things that I know I'm already thinking about. It's not like I'm going to go to the moon in 2 months. It's like, I think I'm going to try to go to Seattle this year because I've wanted to go to Seattle for a few years. So maybe that'll be something that I achieve.
Right. Yeah, I don't get the whole resolution thing.
Well, Sadie just...
Because I feel like I'm constantly making resolutions.
But Sadie's
going
to give me an example.
I make resolutions around the clock. I like to make them at New Year's, but... I've made them in November and said, like, okay, I want to make a resolution now, and then if it sticks, I'm going to keep it and make it, like, a thing for the whole year.
Yeah, I mean...
So I do it whenever it makes sense.
I think Sadie gave us an example before, where she said she had a resolution last year about getting on top of her finances more. And she did. Now, that's the kind of thing... That sounds like a New Year's resolution.
That's vague. Yeah. Like, I didn't say, I'm going to do this, 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 and this. I said I wanted to be more educated, so now I know a lot about my credit score, so I can check that box.
All right. Very good. But anyway, for the good bunnies who are doing the resolution thing...
Also make a disclaimer that I do go to the gym every day, so that's a non-issue for me. I don't have to make that resolution. So that's... Whereas everyone is like, oh, I'm going to work out more this year. I'm like, okay.
Well, and the Wall Street Journal has an article that has some tips for how to achieve your resolutions. What it's saying is one of the most common New Year's resolutions is get more exercise. But how do you do that? When is the best time to get more exercise? And it turns out you should exercise in the morning if you're trying to lose weight, if you're trying to... boost your mood. Cardio workouts can elevate your mood. When we exercise in the morning, we enjoy those effects all day. Or, if we're trying to keep a routine. If you do it in the morning, you're just going to do it. You're going to stick to it. Exercise in the late afternoon or evening if you're trying to avoid injury, trying to perform your best, or enjoy the workout a little bit more. Okay.
Well, I was just going to say I agree with that because I exercise in the afternoon because I don't have an issue with keeping a routine. I'm good at that part. So I exercise in the afternoon because I want to have the presence of mind to focus on what I'm doing and have the time to do it. Whereas in the morning, it's kind of rushed and you have to get it over with quickly so you can go to work. But I'm an afternoon exerciser.
And if your resolution is to be happier and more productive, the key to that, taking breaks.
Taking nature breaks, I think is what you
mean. Nature breaks. Well, not the kind
of nature
breaks.
Does that mean going to the bathroom?
No. That's what I thought. Mom reads it differently.
No. And it's better to take, like, frequent breaks, like 5-minute breaks every hour,
okay,
is actually more effective than that 30-minute break, you know, in the middle of the afternoon.
So, so your definition of nature breaks is going outside, basically?
Yeah, that they find that people actually are happier when they see a little bit of leafage, yeah, or, you know,
but what sky. What if you're in the city and there is no leafage or it's 10 degrees outside?
Then you shouldn't take a break. Just keep working.
Just keep working.
Just take a different kind of break. But the breaks are restorative and help jumpstart you, help reduce your stress.
So I agree with that as well. However, I'm more of the 20-minute walk to the coffee shop break person instead of.
Well, you're not getting the most for your break money then.
That's right.
Well, no, but some people at work don't take breaks and they just end up with, you know, like writer's block, or they just get so kind of crazed every day. And I'm actually really
productive, and you think that's due to your breaks?
No, I'm really annoying about taking a break. Like, I will say to someone, like, I know this is due in 45 minutes. I'm going to take 20 minutes and go walk to Starbucks, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to knock it out so fast. Like, I will take a break pretty much no matter what, and I'm kind of, I have built a little bit of a reputation for that, but I always get my work done and I do it faster.
What that really actually goes to, we don't have to talk about it now, is that the mind works in the subconscious. I mean, when you're taking a break, you're not entirely taking a break. I mean, I have that, and it sounds like Sadie has that experience too. You're trying to figure something out. You don't think about it directly all the time. You take a walk, you do something else, but the mind keeps working on it. And then when you come back to it, you've made progress on it.
And actually, I kind of do the opposite. My life is a break.
Yeah.
And, you know, for 5 minutes every hour, I try to do a little work. All right. Anyway, moving right along here.
All
right.
So the last bit that we're going to talk about movies, and we're going
to
start with
Back to resolutions. If you're trying to save money, you might want to get a movie pass.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that's another way to look at it. Movie pass. We've talked about it before. It's just one of these things. Does that really make sense? Is that really true?
And turns out people are doing it.
And what it is, again, is for $10 a month in a subscription service, you are entitled to go to as many movies you want during that month, as long as the theater chain involved signs up. A lot of them have signed up. There's been some resistance among some theaters, and there shouldn't be, because the way it works is the people selling the MoviePass subscription, the MoviePass people themselves, will reimburse the theater the full amount of the admission ticket if someone goes to the movie on MoviePass. Some theaters, AMC in particular, was objecting at the outset because they said they don't see how MoviePass can possibly survive, and the fallout of their bankruptcy can be difficult for AMC. But MoviePass has a little bit of a secret here, and it's a little bit, I don't know, creepy. They say that, in fact, they're getting a little more out of it than just the $10 a month. They're saying that they're getting the data that they collect in connection with movie-going experience.
That's creepy.
That's a little bit of a hot, sensitive subject right now in terms of mining data, which is personal to people. It doesn't bother me either, Tamsin. But in fact, it's going to get some people excited. They're selling information about you to people who are going to offer you services.
Are they selling information about you, or are they selling information about what movies people are seeing,
right,
when and where, etc. and so
forth. That's correct. That's what it is.
But it is still an interesting story. They have gotten over 1 million subscribers in,
right,
1 month by lowering the price.
Right.
Price started out very high. It was like $50 a month. They lowered it to $35.
And now
they lowered
10.
It to $10. Bingo. I mean, they are beating out a lot of other subscription services in terms of attraction. So that's impressive.
Yeah.
And they are pointing out that, of course, the movie theaters are getting a lot of other benefits besides the money for the ticket. They're spending money in the concessions, et cetera, and so forth. They also point out that 75% of their subscribers are millennials,
right,
which is exactly the group the movie theaters were losing in terms of getting into the theater. And people are excited about it. Les at yoga the other day,
yeah,
said, oh, I've got it. And here was a guy who wasn't going to the movies,
right,
in the theaters at all. He was always talking to me about movies he was streaming or whatever, but suddenly he's seen all the latest movies.
Right. Well, they interviewed a millennial here, and he says, you know, I used to think of a movie as a big event. I only saw the big, big movies.
Because then, it costs so much.
Because it costs enough. And now I'm seeing the movies on the undercard, the second tier, the ones I said, well, do I have to go to the movie theater for that? So, and they give the best example, Lady Bird. Lady Bird's a movie maybe people don't get out of their house to see if it's going to cost them $10. But if it costs them nothing, That creates an audience for Lady Bird. So maybe that is the wave of the future. But...
We'll see if this works.
Right.
Sounds like a deal.
It does sound like a deal, and it's the way the industry might be changing. But there also
hope it helps Shape of Water, because there is a movie that is just a terrific movie.
Yeah.
It's making no money
at all.
Cost $18 million to make, and it's only, to date... gross 13.
Well, the trailer is very weird for that. It's very weird.
There's no way not to be weird. It's a weird movie, but it's a fabulous movie. It's my favorite movie of the year. But we'll close on a note with someone who did it the other way.
We talked a week or two ago about Lincoln Plaza Cinema closing down because they've lost their lease. And that was actually owned by Dan Talbot and his wife. And Dan Talbot just passed away this past week at the age of 91.
Right.
And he was an interesting guy. He actually was still going to the movies up until Friday before Christmas.
Right.
Was still going to the movies. He's a guy who grew up in the Bronx. His dad was, his parents were both in the rag trade. His dad was a textile jobber. His mother had a notions shop. And he went to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a job actually as a film critic for a pacifist magazine, The Progressive, for a little while. Then he lived for a year in Spain. And when he came back, he ends up with his wife renting an old movie theater on the Upper West Side to show, made it into a revival house.
Right.
They start out showing The Red Balloon and Henry V with Laurence Olivier. And it's a huge success. So much so, he starts this in the early 60s, by 1964. Nora Ephron is writing about him. And... they are able to actually buy the theater. They end up distributing these small movies. And their theory was always that they're playing movies that they're interested in, that, you know, they have no sort of agenda.
Right.
They're just movies that not necessarily going to make a lot of money, but are interesting to them, that demonstrate the aesthetic that moves.
And is this the movie theater they had on Lincoln? So that moved on from revivals to basically being an art house. They're showing first run movies, but they're showing esoteric movies.
Right. Well, they had several different projects.
Yeah.
They opened Lincoln Plaza Cinema in 1981,
mm-hmm.
and that's been the longest running one. They also end up as distributors for films, because early on, this one film they want to show, the producers say, well, we'll only give it to you to show if you will distribute it for us.
Right.
So they run that business for a number of years, until the early aughts, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sell that business. But he acknowledged that the audience for these art house films was both small and, as he says, static. He said, it's an elite, college-educated, well-traveled group, very determined, but it isn't growing. He says, when I look at the movies, I don't think of box office. If it appeals to my aesthetic sense, if it has some artistic foundation, I take a chance with it. And that system worked for a good many years.
But maybe no longer, and maybe MoviePass is the solution from now on going forward.
Yes, we have to say that we see a lot of small movies at a small theater called Montgomery Cinema.
Right.
Here in Jersey, and they have started accepting MoviePass.
Right, and we've been to Lincoln Center Plaza. We've been to this movie theater, and it's going to be missed because they play movies that other people don't play.
And just summing all this up, Mr. Talbot disliked cinematic pretentiousness. He told Ms. Ephron that his work should never be viewed with solemnity. In the 1981 Times interview, he also said he insisted that his programming choices had never been intended to shape audiences or advocate any ideology. They were chosen, he said, just to demonstrate the full glory of movies. So happy movie watching in 2018.
Okay.
That's all for this week. Thank you, Sadie.
And and thank you, listeners. We'll see you next week. In 2018?
Tamsin and Dan read the paper.